Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Aziz Haq, a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and is the co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced, Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. And he has an op-ed in The Guardian, How Would Trump Handle a Terror Attack? Welcome to Background Briefing, Aziz Haq.
Thank you, Ian, for having me.
Well, thanks, Aziz. And why did you write this? Was it something to do with the way Trump responded to the terror attack in London, where he clearly spewed out classified information, which Theresa May, the British Prime Minister, had to rebuke him for? And as you know, the British don't like to criticize the Americans because they somewhat defer to them. So did that prompt you to write this piece?
Ian, to be frank, it was really the cumulative responses to a number of crises that we've seen unfurling over the last few months that pushed me to write the piece. So we've had a ongoing humanitarian crisis in Syria involving the use of chemical weapons. We've had the crisis over North Korean missile tests. And then the sequence of natural disasters, Irma and Hugo, that have presented the president to the White House with really an opportunity to show how they respond to serious crises. And I think that we've learned a good deal from observing the ways in which the White House has pivoted on those crises.
Well, the impression I get is that it becomes a public relations effort, or at least it's a question about how Trump appears in the media as opposed to how he deals with the problems.
I think that's right. I think we've seen here a White House that much more so than the normal White House is driven by a desire to appear to be responding, but also more importantly, to have the president appear to be or to use the crisis as a way of burnishing the credentials or the appearance or even the ego of the president. And that, even in comparison to any other president I can think of, it's really new. Especially when you couple it with an ongoing failure to find a meaningful way of grappling with the underlying forces that are causing the crisis. And that's been true in Syria, where the administration really has stepped completely aside after its single very high-profile attack. It's been the case with North Korea, where the level of rhetoric has been in striking contrast to the failure of the administration to muster any new substantial diplomatic initiatives that might alter North Korea's behavior. And it was true for Irma and for Hugo, where, you know, although you had very effectual agency-level responses in the form of FEMA, and you had reasonably competent state-level responses, although maybe we'll find out those are not as competent as one might have hoped. The White House's response was to treat both of these hurricanes as platforms for the president to make some speeches. So it's very similar behavior we've seen in the campaign, very similar to behavior we've seen while he's been governing. You know, I think the Boy Scout speech, for example, exemplified the same kind of tendencies. And it's a deeply worrying tendency when one thinks about the kinds of serious crises that might be coming down the pike.
And again, I'm speaking with Aziz Haq, a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and is the author of Unchecked and Unbalanced, Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. And he has an op-ed at The Guardian, How Would Trump Handle a Terror Attack? Well, the worst aspect, I think, of Trump's bluster and bellicose words, particularly back and forth with the North Korean leader, who is famous for his hyperbole, it doesn't seem to be very useful to lower yourself to the level of Kim Jong-un, because as you see TV footage of South Koreans in the street commenting on the crisis, and of course Seoul is at ground zero for if there were to be a war between the U.S. and North Korea, the collateral damage would be 10 million South Koreans in Seoul. And by and large, the refrain that you hear from the man in the street or the woman in the street in Seoul is that Kim Jong-un is crazy and so is Trump. So that's not a good position for the United States to be in.
I think the situation is a little worse than that, in as much as one of the moves that the White House has made is to threaten, at least in its public statement, a trade war or a diminution or a cutting off of trade ties with South Korea, which obviously has escalated tensions directly with South Korea, in addition to the tensions created by the president's criticism of China and Russia on the North Korea issue. The net effect of these, I think, precipitous and perhaps not fully thought through comments is to drive wedges within the international coalition that did exist to contain and limit Kim Jong-un's regime. And this splintering tension between different elements of the international coalition is really only to the benefit of North Korea. And so what we've seen here is a series of actions that, ironically, by seeking to look tough, end up redounding to the benefit of the North Korean regime.
Well, when just on the domestic side, though, there's been an obvious double standard in Trump's comments. He, of course, was said nice things about the Nazis who demonstrated in Charlottesville. He didn't say a word about the attack on a mosque in Minnesota, and he didn't say a word about the cold-blooded murder of a bunch of worshippers in a mosque in Quebec. But then he talks about, you know, thousands of Muslims celebrating in New Jersey on 9/11, which never happened. Has he already eroded his credibility in terms of this double standard where, you know, Christian, Christo-fascists, for the want of a better description, if they can murder people in Charlottesville, they get a mild rebuke, if anything. And, you know, meanwhile, he makes up all kinds of paranoid notions about Muslims, terrorists under the bed.
Just to be fair to the administration, other officials, such as the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, I disagree with many of the positions that Attorney General Sessions has taken, but after Charlottesville, Sessions took a very hard line on the neo-Nazi protesters, and many other elements of the administration have distanced themselves. So I think one should be a bit more careful. I would be a bit more careful about distinguishing between the different pieces of the administration. But I think the core of your point is absolutely right, that on questions of religion, on questions of race, and in the invocation of quote-unquote inner city violence in cities like Chicago, the president has not shown himself to have an equal measure of concern for all Americans. Consistent with a campaign that, you know, appealed in very lightly disguised ways to the sense that perhaps many white Americans have that their economic and cultural status is slipping, has run as a president for some but not all Americans. And when that translates into policy, as I think it did when the first travel ban was promulgated, and and employed against green card holders who are who have a right to reside, but who are often nationals of the affected countries, with respect to the Dreamers, and the way in which policy decisions of that kind impact not just non-citizens, but many citizens who are related to, married to, live with, depend for their business on Dreamers. I think we've seen a kind of systematic callousness about the interests of some, but not others. So I think the core of your question is absolutely correct.
So what do you think would happen if there were a terrorist attack in this country along the lines of what we've seen in the UK? Because you mention in your article at The Guardian, Aziz, how would Trump handle a terror attack? You mentioned in your article that after 9/11, the FBI had a program called Pentabomb that it was an aggressive use of immigration laws, detained hundreds of suspects, often based on ethnicity or perceived face. An Arab and Muslim communities were swept with voluntary interviews that at times resulted in arrests on insubstantial premises. So would there be large-scale arrests, dragnets, racial profiling? Would that be your
expectation? Well, I obviously have to hope otherwise. I think all of those measures are unwarranted and, frankly, inefficacious, particularly given the forms that the risk now poses. But unfortunately, I think our experience with recent crises, not security crises, but international security crises and natural disasters, suggest that this is an administration that places an emphasis, as you say, on wanting to appear tough, but with very little regard to the underlying dynamic or forces that cause a policy problem. And I think that suggests that it is likely that we would see a reiteration, a re-upping of many of the measures used in the wake of the 9/11 attack. And those were measures principally that involved criminal law and the FBI's investigative authorities, but also the immigration authorities' use of their powers. And they have, as we now get to see, very extensive detention-related powers, too. I would expect to see some of the tools that have been used by other countries since 9/11 adopted. And I think, ironically enough, France is a very good lesson here about the ways in which emergency powers can be used. France has been very aggressive in the wake of the Charlie Hebdo attack in closing mosques, deporting imams, engaging in warrantless searches that are seemingly targeted by little more than ethnicity or race in ways that have had substantial alienating effects on the French Muslim community. In the long term, I think these tactics, while they play well to a political audience, are inefficacious. It doesn't work to use dragnets, particularly when the use of the dragnet is chilling the flow of information from these communities. And as we've seen many, many times before in counterterrorism and counterinsurgency context, treating race or ethnicity or religion as a proxy for risk is a guaranteed way to compound or exacerbate or expand the number of rights violations without doing much that's very effective.
Well, the British obviously have a much greater problem than the United States has, and I think it stems from the difference. As far as I know, the U.S. does not accept returnees from the ISIS war zones, those that have fought with the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, whereas the French let them back and the British let them back as well. They watch them, but watching people 24/7 is an extremely expensive, and many of them have slipped through the cracks. So so to that extent, do you agree that the U.S. situation is a preferable one, not to allow jihadis to return?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things that are going on here. The first is just that the rate of movement from European countries, but particularly England and France, although Germany, I think, has had a relatively high per capita rate. The rate of people going to Syria was higher than the U.S. That's partly a function of proximity, and it's partly a function of the kinds of social communities that you have in Europe that you don't have in America. But more generally, in the longer term, the United States has been much more successful in integrating Muslims into American society when they've been recent immigrants. And I hasten to add that there have been Muslims in the United States since before the nation became a nation. There were many, many Muslims who were slaves who were brought over from the early 1600s onwards. But recent Muslim migration to the United States has generally been far wealthier than analog migrations in Europe. And you've seen people move into professional jobs, intermarry, and find pathways into American society in a way that the more closed social structures and the more tightly controlled labor markets in Europe did not allow. And so I think those are the deep and long-term reasons why the domestic problem is of a different order of magnitude in Europe from the one that's here. I actually don't think that the kind of the policy on returnees is a significant contributor. I think pales in comparison to these other considerations that are much more long term.
Well, just in closing, the British have ubiquitous CCTV, whereas the US doesn't, and it's obviously been a tool that's been used in tracking some of these perpetrators of these terrorist attacks. And I think it was even used in the most recent one in finding these two suspects that they have.
Correct.
Would you, you're a civil libertarian, how do you feel about CCTV? We don't have as much as the Brits do. Should we have more CCTV?
I think that's an interesting question. I actually don't know how much CCTV we have in major metropolitan areas. I suspect it's much more than people think. When you add not just the CCTV that's run by the state, but also CCTV that's run by private companies. Many apartment buildings, many retail and businesses have CCTV that covers the streets outside their properties. It was precisely this kind of private CCTV that's important in the Boston Marathon investigation, for example. So I'm not sure the difference is that great. And I do think there's a difference between CCTV and other kinds of surveillance, but this gets us far afield, but there are increasing ways in which CCTV footage can be used to extract private information in a way that would not have been possible even 5 or 10 years ago. So, for example, there's a widely reported study out of Stanford about how researchers can use machine learning to infer whether somebody is straight or gay based upon their image in CCTV footage. I think one needs to think hard about how and where CCTV footage is used. One needs to think hard about how the government can employ such information, but I certainly don't think it's the case that it shouldn't be used at all or it should be minimized. But the way it is used, I think, presents some interesting and difficult questions.
Well, Aziz Haque, thank you very much for joining us here today.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Aziz Haque, who's a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and is the co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced, Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. And he has a forthcoming book, How Constitutional Democracies Are Lost and Saved. And he has an article at The Guardian, How Would Trump Handle a Terror Attack?